Hello and welcome to the Africa Today podcast from the BBC at 15:30 GMT on Thursday, the 23rd of July. I'm Sophie Ikenye. In the pod today, an alarming increase in the number of kidnappings in Nigeria, but what can be done to stop it?
Once it gets into kidnappings of people around the corner, it's very difficult to control and anyone can attempt to do it. And very often you have failed rescue attempts, people die.
There's been a steep rise in the number of kidnappings in Nigeria. According to the police, more than 500 people have been kidnapped this year. Kidnapping used to be quite common in the strife-torn Niger Delta, where the victims were mostly foreign workers. But now it appears to be spreading to other areas, raising fears among Nigerians themselves. And today, the nation's security chiefs have been meeting lawmakers in parliament to discuss what to do. From Abuja, Chris Ewoko reports.
With the increased incidence of kidnapping and the targets involving children, political and religious figures, people are becoming increasingly cautious in their daily activities and dealings with other people. Many parents, for instance, now prefer to take their children to school themselves and go back to pick them up later when they close. They are also quite careful of whom their children and wards associate with. Even public figures also take the trouble to employ one or two security men to act as escorts. Over the past 3 years, hundreds of foreign workers have been kidnapped, mostly in the Niger Delta region, where militants have been waging a campaign against the oil companies. But with the withdrawal of many expatriate staff by companies in the oil, telecom and construction sectors, gangs are now filling the vacuum by kidnapping Nigerians. Figures recently presented by the Nigerian Minister of Police Affairs, Yakubu Lami, indicate that last year there was about 350 kidnappings. This year, 512 cases have been reported so far. Beyond the restive oil-bearing Niger Delta, many of the cases have occurred in the southeastern part of Nigeria with ransom payments as the driving force. In April, an armed gang kidnapped a 45-year-old Canadian woman visiting the northern city of Kaduna. Although she was released 2 weeks later, this was a sign that kidnapping was spreading further. The problem is particularly worrying to the elite and political class, which explains the reason behind the closed-door meeting today between senators and the nation's security chiefs.
Chris Ewoko in Abuja. Nigeria is not the only country experiencing a rise in the number of kidnappings. Kenya, too, has reported an increase this year. But what can be done to prevent it? Well, one region where lessons could be learned is Latin America. Kidnapping is a big issue in several countries there. In Colombia, for example, nearly 3,000 people were kidnapped in 2002. To explore the issue further, I spoke to my BBC colleague, Leonardo Hocha, who covers Latin American issues in our newsroom.
It started, I remember, in the 70s. There were a lot of political kidnappings with the FARC rebel movement in Colombia. There was in Brazil, there was in Argentina, American ambassadors. But really, with the financial crisis of the 80s and the 90s, you know, the collapse of the economies in those countries, the criminality started to increase. And from robbing banks, it became more difficult. There were more, police around those, and people started to do kidnappings. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the 80s, say in Brazil, that's where I come from, in the 80s, big names were kidnapped, businessmen and politicians for huge amounts of money. And then it went into a very small business. I mean, even now, when I go to Rio, people there have the relatives are kidnapped for a few hours or for a weekend, or they ask for ransom very quickly.
So in that case, how do the authorities deal with such cases?
The first, they try to make it a serious crime, because in many countries there's a legal problem. So they made it a serious crime. In Venezuela, they did it last year. They did it in Brazil. But it hasn't worked very much. The problem with that is, once it starts, the kidnapping industry, it's very difficult to stop it.
What sort of lessons can African countries that are going through such incidences learn from Latin American countries?
The main lesson is to tackle the problem as early as you can, and in a very visible way, in the sense that if the government changes the legislation to make it clear for people, it's a high-risk job. Kidnapping or dealing with someone's life is not like robbing a car. It has to be made clear that it's a big, serious crime, and to avoid the spread of it, because once it gets into you know, kidnappings of people around the corner, it's very difficult to control, and anyone can attempt to do it. And very often you have failed rescue attempts by police where people die.
Leonardo Rocha from the Latin America desk of our newsroom.
President Umaro Musa Yar'Adua of Nigeria has ordered police and troops to use all necessary means to control the violence in the north of the country, which has left more than 100 people dead. It broke out on Sunday when Islamist militants demanding the wider adoption of Sharia law attacked a police station in the city of Bauchi. From Lagos, Caroline Duffield.
Security has been tightened across northern Nigeria and dusk-to-dawn curfews imposed in affected towns. The military have set up roadblocks and are controlling access into and out of major urban areas. People are giving detailed accounts of young men with machetes, crossbows and guns killing police officers and shooting and slashing at civilians at random. In the town worst hit by the violence, Maiduguri, bodies of residents and of the young men have been piled outside the police station and in the streets. Eyewitnesses have described corpses of people killed at random scattered in the roads.
Hello, this is The World Today from the BBC World Service.
Today, dead bodies in the streets, but Nigeria's government insists it's got the lid on religious violence.
The British government about to be sued over CIA rendition.
And Hungary's gypsies feel the heat as the country's far right flexes its muscles.
First, a summary of the main news.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. President Umaro Musa Yar'Adua of Nigeria has ordered police and troops to use all necessary means to control the violence in the north of the country, which has left more than 100 people dead. It broke out on Sunday when Islamist militants demanding the wider adoption of Sharia law attacked a police station in the city of Bauchi.
Nigeria has known violence between Muslims and Christians before, but not like this, and certainly not on this scale. A militant group struck towns in four northern states almost simultaneously, attacking the police and unleashing 2 days of violence. At least 100 people were killed in the ensuing gun battles with the police. The BBC's Bilkisu Babangida in Maiduguri, in the state of Borno, says dead bodies have been left on the streets.
What I saw in front of the police headquarters was a large number of corpses. The army and the police are still on the streets, shooting into the air, and also the entire streets have been deserted. Most of the residents have been fleeing to their families in the non-violent areas, and almost all the shops, banks and offices were closed.
We read our correspondent's words there because of the quality of the line. So who is responsible for these attacks? Well, the militants like to call themselves the Taliban. They want Islamic law rolled out across all northern states. But locals call them Boko Haram, meaning Western education is a sin. And you'll understand why when you hear this. It's an interview we were able to do with the militant's leader, Mohammed Yusuf.
Alhamdulillah wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulullah. Gaskiya ne nace karatun boko a wannan tsari a wannan.
It's true what I said. Western style education in its present curriculum was brought in by the Europeans and it's a sin. It spoils the belief in one God. There are things that we've investigated and found they are contrary to our belief in one God. There are prominent Islamic teachers who have seen and understood that the present Western style of education is mixed with issues that run contrary to our belief in Islam. Like rain, we believe it is a creation of God rather than an evaporation caused by the sun that condenses and becomes rain. Like saying the world is a sphere. If it runs contrary to the teachings of Allah, we reject it. We also reject the theory of Darwinism.
Well, Mohammed Yusuf's militants are thought to have been responsible for other attacks in 2003 and 2004, but since then they seem to have slipped under the radar for the authorities. Now the Minister of State for Information, Aliyu Ikra Bilbis, says the government has the situation under control.
The government of Nigeria has taken all the necessary measures required to protect the lives of people and their properties, and to make sure the violence has not spread to other parts of the country. The government has put the relevant security personnel in the affected areas on alert, so to restore law and order.
That's Aliyu Ikra Bilbis, the Minister of State for Information.
But it leaves the question, are the militants likely to just melt away, or do they have a long-term plan? Perhaps the key lies in understanding exactly who they are and where they come from. Professor Hussein Zakaria has been charting their progress for many years. He's an Islamic scholar in Abuja.
This organization was founded in 2004, and they adopt Afghanistan. They have their own conception of Islam, different from the central Islam, and that is anything Western is un-Islamic, is infidelity, and should be fought by force, and people should return to the true Islamic teachings, their own Islamic teachings, by force. They have quarreled with the government, not with the people, and their first point of attack in every state, as we understand, at the police stations. So they are armed, and they said they're gonna fight Nigerians and Nigerian government until everybody comes to the track of Islam. The government couldn't establish any direct link with the Taliban of Afghanistan. They are just people who are maybe enticed, or they are seeing the glaring courage of the Talibans, and so they dupe themselves Afghanistan or Talibans. But actually, directly, there's no any connection as far as Nigerian government can establish. The leader is called Muhammad Yusuf. He's a graduate, educated, Westerly, very proficient in English. He lives lavishly. They even say that he drives a Mercedes-Benz. He has GSM phone cells, but he is well-educated in the Western context. He started his dissemination of ideas by attacking the Western education and calling it un-Islamic, and whoever engages in the pursuit of Western education is not a Muslim. And in Nigeria of today, where you have people with experience in all kind of economic hardship, and where you have the unemployed graduates as well, and where you have the politicians who are corrupt, you can easily get soldiers of any number who will support your idea, provided you can feed them, provided you can tell them what to do. They are willing to do that. And to do anything against the government by this kind of people is very easy, because they are either unsatisfied with the way the government is being run, or the idea of politics is not acceptable to the people. So they have the feeling that unless they do something, they will not be noticed in the society.
Professor Hussein Zakaria. It's 14 minutes to 6 GMT, and this is our top story here on the BBC World Service. Nigeria's military and police have been ordered to use all means necessary to contain violence in the north of the country. At least 100 people have been killed, but the president of Nigeria says the situation in the north is now under control. On the ground, the picture isn't quite so clear. In retaliation for multiple attacks on police across four northern states at the weekend, the army shelled a mosque and the home of an Islamist militant thought to be leading the attacks. The BBC's reporter in Maiduguri, Bilkisu Babangida, saw what happened. Because of the bad phone line, we've had to voice over her words.
What is happening right now is that armored tanks with military and anti-riot mobile policemen who were brought in as reinforcements from Plateau State began shelling the area where the home of the leader of the Boko Haram group, Malam Muhammad Yusuf, is located. The militants had barricaded themselves in their stronghold around the railway terminus. They have been firing back at the army, or anybody for that matter, who approached their hideout. The joint military-police action is called Operation Flush. You can hear the shelling from a distance, and smoke is billowing into the air from the area.
Well, not surprisingly, lots of civilians are getting out while they can. Aliyu Maikano is in charge of disaster management for the Red Cross in northeastern Nigeria.
Well, almost everyone has fled the town. There are those who have left the town. There are those that might have taken refuge in police stations or in the army barracks. And we haven't been able to reach them.
Most of the violence so far has involved young men arming themselves and attacking local police. Tom Hagler asked Dr. Usman Mohammed, a lecturer in economic and political science at the University of Abuja, why he thinks Boko Haram, this sect, has been able to influence these young men.
In the north, there is what we call traditional Islamic institutions, side by side with Western education. Now, the traditional Islamic institution has for years got prominence. So they now recruit these young ones and put them in this Islamic school and then teach them the tenets of Islam. Nothing wrong with that, okay? But of recent, you have some that get these young ones and then indoctrinate them with certain ideology that is basically out of context with Islam.
We've seen these clashes over four states. Is there a danger that they'll spread over the rest of northern Nigeria? Are these indoctrination centres, as you call them, there? Are there willing followers in these other states as well?
Yes, because you mentioned four states. That's Borno, Bauchi, Yobe and Kano. We now have Katsina. That's the fifth state. Of course, Sokoto, there was massive arrest of these young people. So you now have to understand how these people have large followers over more than six or seven states in the north. And this is basically disturbing. And you must understand that the Nigerian state has become a failed state. This is the issue. The leaders, they don't have what it takes to carry along the lower cadre of the society into democratic governance. In my own definition of a failed state, it's a state that can't deliver its services. Anything goes. And that's exactly what we are witnessing in Nigeria today.
There are a lot of places in the world, though, where they're extremely poor people. They don't have access to a lot of things, education, fresh water, jobs. And yet, you don't get this incredible militant uprising and this attempt to overthrow the state.
I agree with you. But what the massive classes of people down the cadre are watching is the huge gap between the rich and the poor. Let me tell you a little story. I was in Kaduna driving. Somebody came over to me and told me to wind down. I went down my window and he said, give us our money. I said, what do you mean your money? He said, you are a politician. I said, I'm not a politician. He said, you drive a good car. I said, so what? I'm a university lecturer. So this is my hard work. This is my sweat. He said, so what? Because you are educated, so you work for them. The society is rightly divided between us and them. Basically, there is this hatred between those that have and those that don't. This is because the society is not on equitable ground.
Dr. Usman Mohammed.